Support for WPR comes from the Wisconsin DNR. Preventing food waste and composting scraps and uneaten veggies, grains, and fruit can help the environment. More dnr.wi.gov by searching food waste.
But first, David Eagleman. He is a neuroscientist and a fiction writer, the author of Some, 40 Tales from the Afterlives. He talked to Anne Strangechamps about all the different scenarios that he's imagined could happen to us after we die. Here's Eagleman reading the title story, Some.
In the afterlife, you relive all your experiences, but this time with the events reshuffled into a new order. All the moments that share a quality are grouped together. So you spend 2 months driving the street in front of your house, 7 months having sex. You sleep for 30 years without opening your eyes. For 5 months straight, you flip through magazines while sitting on a toilet. You take all your pain at once, all 27 intense hours of it. Bones break, cars crash, skin is cut, babies are born. Once you make it through, it's agony-free for the rest of your afterlife. But that doesn't mean it's always pleasant. You spend 6 days clipping your nails, 15 months looking for lost items, 18 months waiting in line, 2 years of boredom, staring out a bus window, sitting in an airport terminal, 6 months watching commercials, 4 weeks sitting in thought, wondering if there is something better you could be doing with your time, 3 years swallowing food, 5 days working buttons and zippers, 4 minutes wondering what your life would be like if you reshuffled the order of events. In this part of the afterlife, you imagine something analogous to your earthly life, and the thought is blissful. A life where episodes are split into tiny, swallowable pieces, where moments do not endure, where one experiences the joy of jumping from one event to the next, like a child hopping from spot to spot on the burning sand.
David, the pleasure of reading that story is that it almost does to the reader what you posit. It makes you profoundly grateful for this life that we have.
Thank you. That's sort of the point of a lot of the stories in the book, is they shine an interesting angle on our own lives. And I think one comes away from the book with some notion that maybe this is the best of all possible worlds.
Yeah. It's kind of like unstitching a patchwork quilt and reassembling the squares in another shape. I'm wondering, what inspired you to take on this particular subject matter?
I've always been interested in people's stories about the afterlife because it tells you a lot about who they are and what their hopes and dreams and fears are. And I realized at some point that from a literary fiction point of view, using the afterlife as a playing field within which to explore ideas was wonderfully rich. It was a rich area to figure out the joys and complexities of being human. So my book fundamentally has nothing to do with the afterlife, even though all 40 stories are placed in different possible afterlives. The book is really about being human.
You know, I was going to ask you, given that you're a neuroscientist as well as a writer, one of the things that strikes me about the stories is they tend to remind me that, contrary to what we assume, science itself is a story. It's a story we make up, or scientists make up, to fit certain data sets. You have so much fun imagining different stories to fit the basic facts of our existence. Is this also what you do as a scientist?
That's right. That's exactly it. Science and writing are very similar in that you go into the lab every day and you make up really good stories. Of course, with science, what you do is you make up stories all day long, and then you look back to what we know and you try to build a bridge there. And if you're able to build a bridge, then that's progress. And if you're not able to build a bridge, then you've just thought of a really neat, interesting idea. And what I do is I go home at night and I use literature as a channel to further explore those ideas. The part that I've been addressing over the last few years is that both with scientists and with religious folks, there's a lot of pretend certainty that I see, where people act as though they absolutely know what the right answer is. I think that's what I was addressing in this book from both sides. The interesting part about what's happened with this book is that it's been really taken up by both atheists and religious folks. And I don't know of another book like that. It's really cracked me up to watch the progress of this. The people who have blurbed the book are some very famous scientists and atheists. And at the same time, the book just was recently named one of the top 10 spiritual books of 2009. So I think it's fantastic. I think I'm hitting a middle ground where it's sort of a celebration of the vastness of our ignorance instead of pretending like I've got an answer.
Well, anybody who can manage to delight both those camps is clearly doing something right. One of the things I really love that you do in these stories is the way you play with scale. So among all the different possible things we can have gotten wrong about creation, we discover all these things in the afterlife. So, for instance, there's a story called Angst, in which we discover that we've completely misunderstood the scale of creation. Can you describe that story?
Yeah, in that story, it turns out that what we really are these giant 10-dimensional creatures that stand 1,000 kilometers tall in every direction. And we run these very tough jobs of upholding the cosmos, where we have to build structural support to keep the universe from collapsing. And we do that for hundreds of years at a time. And then every few hundred years, you get a vacation. And we all choose the exact same thing. We choose to project ourselves into these tiny, delicate, three-dimensional little creatures that we call humans. And we take a vacation on the little resort that we call Earth. And what happens on Earth is that we just don't care about the bigger issues. All we care about are things like joy and love and light and the tone of a loved voice and the orientation of a house plant and the arrangement of hair. And those are the things we care about when we're here on Earth. And so when these delicate little bodies wear out, and we expand back into what we really are, these huge creatures, we end up spending our time wet-eyed, looking out into the cosmos, yearning for more meaninglessness.
Now, there's a counterpoint story, Spirals, in which we die and meet our creators, who turn out to be much, much smaller than we'd thought. Is there a little bit of that one you could read for us?
Sure. Yeah, I'll just read the opening paragraph.
Okay.
In the afterlife, you discover that your creator is a species of small, dim-witted, obtuse creatures. They look vaguely human, but they are smaller and more brutish. They are singularly unintelligent. They knit their brows when they try to follow what you are saying. It will help if you speak slowly, and it sometimes helps to draw pictures. At some point, their eyes will glaze over, and they will nod as though they understand you, but they will have lost the thread of the conversation entirely. So what happens in this story is you wake up in the afterlife, and all these creatures are surrounding you, and they're all asking you the same thing. They're saying, "Do you have answer? Do you have answer?" And it turns out you find out that we are essentially these big, giant computational robots that were built by these creatures over hundreds of years of them working on it. And the idea is that they made machines that were smarter than themselves so they could answer the question of their existence. And of course, you don't have any answers for them. And what you start to realize as they're questioning you is that we build machines that are smarter than ourselves to try to answer things. And we don't know if those machines have taken on a life of their own.
How does it end?
What happens is it makes them sad because they realize that their project has failed. They believe that we have the answer, but we're too advanced to communicate it at their level. The last paragraph says, they don't guess that we have no answers for them and that our main priority is to answer these questions for ourselves. They don't guess that we are unable and that we have built machines of increasing sophistication to address our own mysteries. You try to explain this to the creatures, but it is fruitless, not only because they don't understand you, but also because you realize how little you understand about our machines.
Yeah, that's beautiful. You know, that's a theme that comes up a lot, the sadness of the creator. You know, whoever the creator is, the odd little stupid creatures, or God, and you have many different versions of God. You know, in some stories she's a woman, in one she's a married couple, but in most of them, God seems a bit powerless over us.
I thought that was an interesting theme to explore. One of the stories is called Mary, and when you arrive in the afterlife, you find that Mary Wollstonecraft Shelley is sitting on a throne, and she's cared for and protected by a covey of angels. And you find out that God's favorite book is Shelley's Frankenstein. And he sits up at night and he clutches a worn copy of this book in his mighty hands. The reason, it turns out, is because he has a very deep, painful relationship with the notion of creation, because he created this gorgeous biology, all these fantastic things, and yet eventually he sort of lost control over it. And he couldn't stop all the warfare and so on. And so he now locks himself in his room, and at night he sneaks out onto the roof with his copy of Frankenstein. And he consoles himself with this thought that all creation necessarily ends in this, where it's creators powerless, fleeing from the things they have wrought.
David Eagleman is a neuroscientist and a writer. He spoke with Anne Strangechamps about his book, Some, 40 Tales from the Afterlives.